Instruction
techniques.
For technology. Hello, people. What up, internets? We are here today to do a brief introductory podcast on the constructionist approach to learning and inquiry-based learning. You're going to have to bear with us a little bit because this is our very first podcast, and we are messing with new computers and stuff and a refrigerator that likes to turn on in the middle of the podcast. So let me introduce myself. I am Joe.
And I am India.
And as I said, we are in a graduate class for education and integrating technology.
Okay, so let's start out talking about the constructionist approach or constructivism, just depending on which way you like to say it. And that basically just says that humans generate knowledge and meaning based on their experiences that they already had and their ideas. So as a theoretical framework, think of it like building blocks for education. You basically want to say that students already have a schema for anything that we want to teach them. How much of that knowledge is already there, we need to know first. So you always want to make sure that you do some type of pre-assessment. And then you build on that knowledge for new knowledge. The basic ideas of constructivism is there's some form of guided discovery where teacher avoids just direct instruction. So you want to ask questions. You want to try to get them engaged. You want to lead the students in the right direction and make sure that they are understanding what it is that they need to understand to have a grasp of the topic. You want to sit down and say, okay, well, here's some activities that we can do. Let's have an open discussion. I want you to appreciate this. And you want to verbalize what it is that they need to get away from the assignment or lesson or unit that you are teaching them. So some methods to do this in class are experimentation, which is you want the students to do some type of hands-on activity to make sure that they understand the topic. You want them to research, so you may do that with a project followed by a discussion. Sometimes it may be easy to have one group study one topic and another group study another topic, and then maybe get them together and do some collaborative learning and have them teach the topics to one another. So you'll have an expert group A and an expert group B, and then they'll exchange knowledge. There's field trips. This is a wonderful way to get kids out of the classroom, get them immersed in their learning, have them in a different environment. Maybe you'll have a movie that's related to the topic that you want to introduce. This is a visual context way of teaching them. That way they can see it in its context, which is great for history or maybe art, something visual. So we have our visual learners covered there. The role for a teacher in constructivist classrooms is that you are more of a facilitator. You don't want to just be in the front of the class doing direct instruction and the students are just sitting there writing everything that you're saying down. You're supposed to be modeling, coaching, scaffolding, which is building on what they know, just teaching above where they're at. And then making sure that they cover that knowledge. But you don't want to just give them a lecture and a bunch of notes because, you know, we don't learn like that, right? Another important thing for a constructivist learning environment is that you want to make sure that the class is built around a question or an issue or an idea. So it may be a case study, which is something that would probably be more of a short-term lesson, or a long-term project, which may take an entire unit, maybe even an entire grading period, or some type of problem. So you introduce the problem, and it's up to the students to try to figure it out. And we've had some great experiences with that in this classroom, right?
Right, yeah. Most of our class is based on that. We only talk for 3 or 4 minutes in like a formal teacher-instructor scenario, and then it's kind of helping each other out where some of us know more and some of us know less, and we kind of help each other build off of our strengths and weaknesses. And then Garth, our instructor, steps in and realizes when as a group we need help.
Right.
And kind of pauses things and lets them go as he sees fit.
Right. Group collaboration like we're doing right now. And one thing that we're using in this class, and that's also great to have a constructivist classroom, is that you want to make sure that you're assessing in different ways. You don't want to just give the paper and pencil test. So one thing that Garth does, and you can do it in any classroom, is he finds creative ways to make sure that he's checking that we're learning. He's asking good questions. The assessments for constructivist assessment based learning is observation of the students, looking at the students' work. Maybe you want to ask the students their point of view, have discussions, and if they're not getting it, maybe you can re-guide them or say, oh, that's a good thought, but maybe you could think of it like this. Students really respond to that, because that way you're not saying that what they think is not valid, but instead you're giving them another way to look at it, a different direction.
Right.
And then you're also validating them.
Yeah, and I think that helps when students have issues with certain subjects. That's not like they're getting back a test with an F on it, mm-hmm. but they're learning how to rethink the problem or the mm-hmm. question or the book and kind of help themselves learn that what they might have thought wasn't wrong, but there's a better way of doing what they were doing. And I'm rambling. So I'll let you finish.
Well, I really like the idea of discussions, because that's when we really get to say, well, no, I don't believe that. I believe this instead. And then as a group, maybe if someone says something and maybe the teacher as the facilitator believes is totally incorrect, the other classmates can chime in, and rather than the teacher saying, well, no, I don't think that that's what we meant, the other students can say, well, maybe you can think of it this way. And you always want to encourage positive thinking. You always want to encourage people to be polite and not hurt their peers' feelings. But through things like pre-testing, you can see what students are thinking and whether they're ready for a certain topic. Maybe you need a little bit more preparation. Maybe they need more background. You want to provide them with hands-on activities. So you don't want them to be sitting at a desk. You want them to be moving around, working at centers. Maybe there's a research center. Maybe there's a experiment center all in one lesson. So you don't have to just take one part of the constructivist methods. You can definitely use different parts. So I always say that you have to keep kids organized. So maybe you'll have a some type of organizational tool, and all they have to do is fill in their answers and fill in what they think and fill in what their group thought, and then they can put notes on the side. And that's also good ways to teach study skills to students who are learning to think differently and organize their thoughts.
Right, definitely. And I think that keeping kids engaged basically comes down to keeping things different. And constructionist approach really helps create opportunities for teachers to have a wide variety of ways to present the information, have the students learn about it, and then assess them in the end.
So for more information, you can go to wikipedia.org, put in constructivist approach or constructionist approach in the classroom for education, and check it out. So right now we're going to have inquiry-based learning. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. Inquiry-based learning works very closely with the constructionist approach, and actually it's based on the constructionist approach. What inquiry-based learning does is it gives the students basically the ability to go out and learn from themselves by not knowing all the answers or all the information they're learning from. So it was developed during the movement of constructionists during the 1960s. And it was developed because there was a perceived failure of the more traditional forms of discussion. It was the progress of the students is basically assessed by how well the students develop an experimental and analytical skills rather than how much knowledge they possess. That is, that they want to know that the students have the drive to go out and find the information and know how to find the information should they need it. Not so much if 2 + 2 = 4, but to knowing how to answer 2 + 2 = 4. The process of inquiry basically starts with gathering the information and data for students to begin with. So information, if you're learning history, you know, like time period and dates, and like data if you're doing like more mathematical or analytical things, like, you know, a graph or a select number set or what have you. Then basically the students apply a selected number of their senses, being hearing, touch, tasting, smelling, basically everything that makes any person curious. Because the funny thing about inquiry-based learning is that it's one of the first things that you learn to use as a human being. And it's a process that you carry from the time you're born to the time you die. It was just when the constructionist approach in the 50s and 60s came about that educators decided to try and turn it what was a psychological term into more of an identifiable education tool.
So in other words, you're saying that it's innate. It's something that we're born with, like a baby putting a pacifier in their mouth or putting a cookie or something that they shouldn't. They just want to explore the world around them.
Right. Inquiry implies a need or want to know. It's a student-led and student-centered process. The idea is to engage active learning in the learner. And basically, there were two educators who researched this, and basically what they thought was that there are four distinct levels of inquiry-based learning, from the first bottom, easiest level, to the top. And as I'll read these and define them, but as you'll see, the first level involves the most amount of instructor assistance, and the last level almost leaves the students to their own devices. Mm-hmm. So the first level of confirmation inquiry, students are provided with a question and a procedure on how to find the answer to it. And most of the time, the results are known in advance. It'd be like having students research a historical event where the outcome was already known. It's a definitive set of answers. The goal of this is to have the students basically practice their inquiry skills and work on collecting, storing, and recording data. The second level is structured inquiry, and this is where the students are given a little more leeway. The question and the procedure are still provided by the teacher. However, students generate an explanation supported by the evidence they've collected. So maybe it's having students learn something about science and coming up with how the reaction happened, why A plus B equals C, not just knowing the answer, but explaining why the answer happened. And this is great to what you were saying, where no matter if they're right or wrong, they still did the work to try and figure out the answer. Mm-hmm. The third level is guided inquiry, and this is where the teacher provides the students only with a research question. From there, the students design their own method for finding out the answer to the question, and then they go out, they test their answer to figure out if whether they have learned is true or false. And this is mostly successful when students have had numerous opportunities to learn and practice in different ways and to have experience planning their data recording and how they're going to experiment. So that's kind of like the third step up to where students are almost there. They're almost the top scaffold. Mm-hmm. And then the last based, which is completely student-based, is open inquiry. And this is where students have the purest opportunity to act like scientists, to come up with questions, to design and carry out investigations, and to communicate their results. This level requires the most amount of scientific reasoning and the greatest cognitive demand for the students. So this works really well with, like, upper-level students, you know, almost college-age students, where you can just give them a question or an inquiry and let them go and bring you back an answer. And this also works well with educators that don't see black and white, because a lot of times you're going to give students a question to figure out, and you're not going to know what you're getting back from.
Joe, I really like the idea of using a web quest for students, which is a way of using higher level thinking. And students can't just summarize. They really have to go out and do the work. But it has to be a task that is ideally scaled down, but adults could definitely do it. So there's a few characteristics that a real web quest entails. So there's always an introduction, which is a short paragraph to introduce the activity to our lesson to the students. There may be a role or a scenario that you have to introduce, and kind of like a stage or setting the stage for them. There's a big question, big idea that guides the rest of it. Next, you have a task, which describes clearly what the end result needs to be. So you don't want to list steps that students will go through, but you do want to say, okay, this is part of a process. Next, the process is to accomplish the task. So there's something that the students have to do to meet the final ending point. So learners will assess online resources that you've identified all, you know, previously for them to look at. and they'll go through a process block. You might also have some guidance on how to organize the information that they gather, which is a great, once again, a good study tool that they'll need in college. And in the end, there's an evaluation to make sure that they did it correctly. It describes learners how their performance will be evaluated. The assessment is on a rubric. It should align with some type of ending performance, maybe an ending project presentation, or something that they have to say, this is where I am as an individual or a group, this is what we came to. So the conclusion to the entire web quest will be to summarize the learners have accomplished. So they may say, you know, this is what I've learned, this is what I think, this is what I felt as I went through this process. Maybe they had some hiccups on the way. Anything like that they want to include in their conclusion. So that's the five steps. There's an introduction, task, the process, evaluation, and conclusion.
Yeah, that's a web quest are one of my favorite problem-based learning tools. And if you want to learn more about web quests or even search through some pre-made web quests or learn about some tools to help you make a web quest, you can check the link that's going to show up in your little viewer right now, and that will direct you to an awesome website where we actually got a lot of our information from that's really helpful. I think we're pretty good for this first introductory podcast.
Yeah, we did a great job.
I think so, too. But we have to first give some props to our websites on our blogs. Mine is artwithmrc.weebly.com. And there you can follow my blog. And yours?
I am languageartsfortomorrow.weebly.com. So definitely go on there to find interesting remarks on educational tools.
Excellent. And we will also post those to the podcast. So if you are not listening to this on a radio, you can click through and check them out. Until next time, thank you very much.
Thank you.